This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Stark. I am joined here with Kevin Lin of Progressives for Immigration Reform. We're going to be discussing the swamp swallowing Donald Trump on immigration. Kevin, great talking to you.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for having me back on the show. How are you?
Excellent. So, Kevin, you've been on this show a number of times, but do you want to give a brief introduction to the organization Progressives for Immigration Reform for people in the audience who are listening to this for the first time?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm the executive director of Progressives for Immigration Reform. We are a group that's about 10 years old. We were founded with the sole purpose of having a conversation with our progressive brothers and sisters who are left of center on the unintended and sometimes intended consequences of unbridled immigration and illegal immigration. And initially, when we began, we were really looking at, you know, how immigration was impacting those who were the most vulnerable in our society, those perhaps on the less skilled side of the house. But we've since grown it to really look at skilled labor as well and the very productive class. So we have Progressives for Immigration Reform, which looks at environmental impacts of immigration and increasing the size of our population. And then we look at labor issues. And we actually created a group called U.S. Tech Workers that looks specifically at skilled workers and the impact of employment visas that have really been ratcheted up over the last 20 years, and in particular, the last 10 years, and are being used to displace workers. And then, of course, earlier last year, we created a group called Doctors Without Jobs that looks at what's going on with our medical profession in terms of bringing in foreign-trained physicians, while at the same time, every year, roughly 1,000 medical doctors who graduate from U.S. medical schools are not getting residencies. And as you know, if you don't get a residency, you can't get, you'll never get a license and never practice medicine. So those are the things we focus on. So as you can tell, we focus a lot on labor issues when it comes to immigration.
So this whole issue with Trump and support for legal immigration, this came out in the recent State of the Union address. And Trump came out in support of increasing levels of legal immigration. And basically, Trump's excuse was that he turned around the economy. So since there's no more unemployment, that's his excuse for dramatically increasing immigration.
Well, I'll tell you, I've always, whether it's someone like, it's President Trump who's in office, President Obama, Bush, Clinton, go back. Ever since, Clinton, and I don't trust the U3 employment data. I look at U6, because the problem with the way we report unemployment in this country is if someone has stopped looking for a job after a year, they're not counted at all. So what we're not really looking at and taking into account are those who are underemployed. A lot of people working several part-time jobs out there. People who have simply given up looking for work because they're no longer counted. And I've always been rather skeptical when I hear these employment statistics. And I know of workers being displaced day in and day out. In fact, I just got an email from one of our U.S. tech workers. We've been forming little groups around the country. And in our District of Columbia group, he said for the second time, he has been replaced by an H-1B visa holder. So these are the things that are this. So I'm always skeptical when I hear this full employment or just 3% unemployment. But getting into where I would say that the swamp has swallowed President Trump, and it is essentially this. You know, President Trump, when he was candidate Trump, he had people who were displaced tech workers who'd been replaced by H-1B visa holders, their whole department outsourced in one fell swoop. And so he's cognizant of the impact that employment visa abuse has. And he talks a lot about illegal immigration and how that impacts Americans. But he doesn't seem to have ever connected the dots between supply and demand when it comes to labor. So if we get, you know, are able to stamp out, let's say, illegal immigration, but we double the number of employment visas, we're going to continue to displace Americans, and we're going to continue to see wages and benefits spiraling downward. And it's simply, so my issue with Donald Trump at this point is he has not connected the dots between supply and demand when it comes to labor. And that's something that we were very much aware of in this country, certainly during the progressive movements or the populist movements of the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
So you're talking about like William Jennings Bryan?
Correct. William Jennings Bryan, that group, because what they did, when you look at, for instance, the early tenets of groups like the AFL-CIO, all of these unions at the time, they understood that corporations were able to bring over large numbers of immigrants and use them to halt their union organizing activities and displace them on the job. So starting in the mid-1920s, we actually had the first laws restricting immigration. And by the, boy, when my mother came here in 1952, I'm the son of an immigrant, we only let out 178,000 green cards that year. And it was a good time for immigrants who came here. It was a good time for the native-born workers, citizens, because we built the middle class and we're building up the middle class. Labor scarcity creates a virtuous cycle of forcing corporations to pay higher wages and use benefits to attract better workers and invest in those workers. I've talked to a number of senior tech workers, folks who are in their late 50s, mid 60s, who, when they entered the workplace, they didn't have a tech background, but their companies are like, well, we're getting these mainframes in and we're going to send you to a 2-month course at IBM. So companies were investing in their employees at that time. And we just don't see that right now in the U.S. Everyone seems to be disposable. And education is the onus of the worker now. And that kind of gets us into a whole nother, go down the rabbit hole of student debt and credentialization.
Oh, yeah, because it really doesn't matter if someone comes here legally or illegally, because it's the, well, obviously there's the sheer numbers. But the key thing to point out, one of the main reasons it doesn't matter is because those legal immigration bills are crafted for the benefit of corporations. So maybe as an individual, they're doing the right thing and respecting our law. But just looking at the big picture, I mean, to me it doesn't matter, because if they're benefiting, if that law is crafted by a corporate corporate interest that's not looking out for the nation's interest.
Right, absolutely. And we see, for instance, with these employment visas, in particular H-1B, in which they're bringing over quote-unquote skilled workers. The vast majority come from India. Three-quarters of the H-1B visas are folks coming from India. The 86% of those visas are for skill levels 1 and 2 out of a scale of 4. So we're not getting these extraordinary talented individuals. They're actually very ordinary workers, the vast majority. And there's some 700,000 H-1B workers in the U.S. today, because we bring in about 94,000 a year. And they're for 3-year terms, and typically they are allowed to renew for 3 years. And now that the visa is dual intent, while they're here, they can change the work visa into an immigration visa and apply for a green card.
So Trump came out in favor of this increase in legal immigration, and there's a number of different bills that we can get into, but has Trump so far endorsed any of those particular bills?
When I look at things like, for instance, we were very successful in stopping a bill called H.R. 392 last year.
Was that the Yoder bill we talked about?
Correct, the Yoder bill. Well, it's reared its head again, and it's now called H.R. 1044. And it seems to more than likely, if it goes to Trump's desk, he will sign it. So he seems to be highly supportive because he just hasn't connected the dots between supply and demand when it comes to labor. And this, to me, is pretty scary, particularly with a Democratic Congress now, and many of them are, as you can see from the presidential hopefuls, are rabidly open border. And I can't, for the life of me, Robert, I don't understand how the party that claims or purports to be the party of labor can not get this connection between massive amounts of immigration and the impact it's going to have on workers here in this country.
What has been Jared Kushner's role in reshaping legal immigration? There's been talk from different media sources that there's been these secretive talks on immigration at the White House.
Well, I am less concerned of the activities of Jared Kushner and more concerned about where he's getting his information from. And that, and I'm specifically looking at the Koch brothers. And my concern is that he's just getting, for decades, the Koch brothers. I mean, it's so funny to have seen when Bernie Sanders was candidate Sanders in 2016. Before he'd become a candidate, he had connected the dots when someone was talking about increasing immigration. He said, "No, that's a Koch brothers platform." And when you look at who seems to be, it seems to be a cabal of Koch brothers inspired lobbyists that are having conversations with Jared Kushner. And so me, it's less about Jared Kushner and more about the people he's getting his information from.
So you would say that Kushner is brought up a lot in the media, would you say, almost as a distraction from these other powers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot going on behind the scenes here. A lot of special interests are pushing an agenda that simply isn't going to help workers in the U.S. They do not have our best interests in mind, and I think the best thing that can happen is to, in the court of public opinion, rule that Jared Kushner needs to spend less time with what I consider some pretty nefarious characters.
And as far as Trump goes, I mean, he's really flip-flopped on this issue, because a while back we came out in support of the RAISE Act, which would have capped immigration at 400,000 a year, illegal immigration, uh-huh. And
Because right now immigration is about 1.2 million here. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
So as far as the one, you said 1.2 is legal immigration. Is that a cap?
No, that's just kind of where things are playing out. That there are not caps necessarily, but there are quotas. And so we seem to be hitting that in terms of family green cards being issued, employment green cards being issued. We're coming out at about 1.2 million.
So I was reading this article Progressives for Immigration Reform published on the site and by Joe Gazzardi. And Joe Gazzardi also published something here in the local newspaper, the News Press. But he made an interesting point, is conservatives like to talk about the hypocrisy of liberal elites, but he actually makes the same point about Trump, because Trump, he has such a lavish lifestyle. We can import like 10 million immigrants a year, and he's just so far isolated from all these issues that he's not really invested in it. And I mean that's the problem of most political leaders, but a lot of people saw Trump as this populist savior.
Yeah, they really did. But honestly, when you look at his stump speeches of 2016, it was all focused on illegal immigration. And yes, you know, because he had the Gold Star families up on stage with him. He had, you know, people like Don Collins, a displaced tech worker, up on stage with him. Dina Moore, a displaced tech worker. And yet, he just never really made that connection that, wow, if we cut down on legal immigration, it's going to create this virtuous cycle of higher wages, better benefits, more employment security, a host of things. And he never seems to have gotten that. Based looking at his Trump speeches, he was, you know, talking, and he would say things that, frankly, made me cringe in 2016. You know, the rapist comments, and I was thinking to myself, and I'd had many conversations with people saying, all he has to do is talk about supply and demand, and people would get it. I believe when you look at 2020, if he doesn't make this connect, if he doesn't connect the dots, and understand that it is not just illegal immigration and MS-13 and the key is to make everyone legal who comes in and increase the number of legal visas. No, it's the numbers of workers coming in that's impacting us. And, you know, and what's interesting too is I think there's a real audience for this, not in just what we call the flyover states, the red states, but also the coastal states, the liberal states, because this is really impacting people with college degrees at this point. As I had mentioned, we have roughly 700,000, Goldman Sachs puts it at close to 900,000 H-1B workers here in the U.S. right now. These are jobs that could be going to graduates of U.S. colleges and universities and community colleges. It was interesting. When I was in Pasadena once, I met with one of the trustees of City of Pasadena Community College. And over lunch, we were talking about this issue. And I pulled out my laptop, went into our H-1B database, and I said, look, you have over 4,000 H-1B applications for the Pasadena area for skill levels 1 and 2. These are people competing directly with your college graduates. And that's where Trump, I think, is really hurting us right now. And it's not to say it's all negative, because he has, you know, there have been some positive things that have happened on the immigration front with his presidency. But I think he just doesn't get it here. And we really need to threaten him politically, I think. Worker citizens in 2020 need to kind of say, look, if you're not going to defend our jobs, which is the number one promise he made in that election, I can't see where he can count on their support.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see someone primary him, but unfortunately, the people who would primary him are even more open border, or are far more for much more immigration than he is. Like that, I think his name's Weld, a former governor from Massachusetts. Yeah, he would be. He's even to the left of immigration as Donald Trump. So right. What you were saying is really crucial, because this is where an organization like Progressives for Immigration Reform comes in. So you just look at the people who are most outspoken and just kind of the barriers. I think I do talk to a lot of people who are kind of progressives from middle to upper middle class backgrounds in places like California. And I guess they just sort of have this knee jerk reaction that immigration restriction is they associate with Donald Trump and the right wing. And then the other issue is that historically it has impacted more working class people, but now it is impacting white collar professionals and the upper middle class. So I think for this, I think it is really crucial to expand the demographic and reach out in places like New York and California and the DC Metro.
Yeah. And it really, it's, and you bring up an interesting point in that we need to almost get out of this liberal conservative paradigm, progressive Tea Party paradigm. What's the adage? You know, I'm looking forward to the day when the gay pot farmers, are defending, their farm with their guns. That's kind of where we need to be as a country. It's almost like we need to grow up. And as you had mentioned, I think a lot of, if Trump were to say the sky is blue, a large portion of the country would say, oh, no, it's red. I see it. It's red. And that's not helpful.
The other worst case scenario that could happen is that if Trump really screws up and he loses, basically it's his fault for selling out to corporate interest. But I think what could actually happen is one scenario is Trump could lose to the Democrats, but then they say Trump lost because he was too right-wing on or restrictionist on immigration, and they'll just use that as an excuse, both the Democrats and the GOP, to go even further for mass immigration.
That would probably be the worst case scenario, I think, and it is probable. And I think we have to also look at the possibility of him not making it to 2020. There are an awful lot of forces. I mean, he's constantly battling one investigation after another, and that's a fact. That's something you probably wouldn't have to factor into prior administrations. And again, what would the impact be? That is something that I am deeply concerned about. And who would rise up? I just don't see any other Republican out there, as you had mentioned, that would it be able to drive this kind of a populist movement.
Yeah, there's some speculation about Tucker Carlson running in the primary, but I doubt that's going to happen.
Well, you want to hear something funny. So 3 weeks ago, 3 Sundays ago, I was doing a counter demonstration in front of the White House. As I had mentioned, H.R. 392 has reared its head. So these Indian lobbies like Immigration Voice are trying to get Congress to remove the country caps so that Indians will pretty much dominate the green card system for the next 10 years. Because these are the people here on the H-1B employment visas and OPT and L-1s who are really abusing that program. So we did a counter demonstration. They said thousands of them were going to show up in front of the White House. So 4 of us went down there, and only about 130 protesters there. And the guy running it, the group was, called the Republican Hindu Coalition. And the guy running it was a guy named Kumar, very distinguished white-haired gentleman. And I was far away at the time, and I didn't see what was going on, but someone had filmed it. And it was the next day that I'm going through the video. I'm like, oh my God. So in the video, Kumar calls. He goes, Buckley, Buckley, come up here, come up here. And it's Buckley Carlson, Tucker Carlson's brother.
Oh, really?
Yes. And he brings him in. He goes, this is our friend. He's very influential. He knows many policymakers. He's on our side.
And so Buckley's obviously the Republican Hindu coalition is for this bill.
Oh, yeah. Newt Gingrich, oddly, not oddly, I guess, Rand Paul, they seem to be throwing their support at this. Also, again, politics makes for the strange bedfellows. Tulsi Gabbard, who I...
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that because I really like Tulsi Gabbard on most issues, but on this issue, she's pretty horrendous. I'll say the same as... I mean, I also like... Who's the candidate for the basic income?
Andrew Yang?
Yeah, I mean, I really like him on most... A lot of issues as well.
I mean,
but...
he's sensible. I'm not for, you know, and I've watched a couple things of his, and I read several things from him, and he certainly makes a convincing argument. He hasn't sold me on it, because I just know myself, surf personally, the value of work. But, but they seem to be so dismissive of what is going on. You think about the kids that are going to college, the amount of debt they're being straddled with. I mean, they need to be making good money. Certainly nothing less than $65,000 a year to service the debts that they're incurring. That's just, you know, I look back, I'm getting close to 60 now, and I think I left college with $3,000 in debt. My nephew left with, I think, $85,000 in debt. So we need to have good paying jobs, and these, whether it's unbridled immigration, employment visas, this is all really destroying workers in America. It's amazing to me that we see people to the far left and the far right supporting these programs the way they do.
And I guess another interesting thing about, I mean, this is another example of interesting bedfellows, is the National Iranian American Council actually came out against this bill because they said it would discriminate against smaller nations. This was from, including, they're talking about Iran in particular, but they said it would discriminate against small nations like Iran in favor of large nations like India. And, I mean, that's fascinating. And I'll read this quote. This is from The Statesman. So it says, for example, a petroleum engineer with a master's degree who was born in South Africa can immediately complete the last step and become a permanent resident. By contrast, an engineer from China will likely have to wait in line for 3 to 4 years, and an individual from India can spend decades waiting. So basically what this bill would do, as The Statesman and the National Iranian American Council points out, is that it would discriminate against smaller countries in favor of large countries, primarily India.
Correct, because, and it's like anything, and the way that will work is it gets into the country cap. So no country, regardless of how many people are queued up, they have their, the I-485 submitted, they've applied for a green card, no more than 7% from that one country can get a green card. So when you flood the system, as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of H-1B holders are from India and from China. Now, back in before the George H. Bush administration, the H-1B visa was an employment-only visa. Well, they changed it to a dual intent visa. So you get here on an H-1B visa, and you can then apply for a green card for citizenship. Now, as I'd mentioned earlier too, you know, the initial term for an H-1B is 3 years. And most people can reapply, and it's usually approved for another 3 years or 6 years. So if you're waiting in line for a green card and you it's beyond 6 years, you would return to your country and have to wait. Well, they changed it. They said, well, if you're in the queue, you can go ahead and stay here. So that's why there's such a huge backlog of Indians in the, you know, in our immigration system.
So what could hypothetically happen is India could completely overwhelm immigration, and other groups would be completely pushed out.
That's exactly what would happen. So because you would have everyone that all the immigration would be based on what they call a It's a PD. It's a priority date. So what had limited the Indians from taking all the quota of employment-based green cards in a given year was that 7% cap. Get rid of that, because now the text isn't finalized, and I haven't even seen a summary for HR 1044, the new HR 392. But what they're saying is, like, other countries will be limited then to, they'll hold the door for them at 25%. So like you have Indians dominating, but 25% would then be allotted to everyone else. So that's kind of what they're looking at.
So right now, Mexico is still the largest source of legal immigration. So if this bill were to pass, India would probably surpass Mexico.
Oh, easily, I believe. Absolutely. When you look at the numbers that are queued up, certainly for the next 6 years. Leon Fresco, the lobbyist for Immigration Voice, said when this, quote-unquote, when this goes through, he's talking about HR 392 at the time, it would, Indians would dominate the green card system for 6 years. Other people like John Miano, who's an attorney and has done a lot of work in this area, thinks it'd be 10 years.
So this bill, it's called Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants Act, which is basically an oxymoron. But this bill is sponsored by Kamala Harris, who's running for president, Senator of California, and Utah Republican Mike Lee. Would it just end the per country caps, or would it dramatically increase the overall numbers of legal immigration?
No, it would probably keep it would ultimately keep the number the same. What we'd see is an end of diversity. And the Harris bill is in the Senate. That's S386. And the bill in the House is HR 1044.
Diversity is important as far as immigration goes, because I hear conservatives criticize the diversity lotto, and I mean, there definitely are legitimate critiques of that, but part of the reason that assimilation happened during the Ellis Island wave of immigration was because of the source of immigrants was widely diverse. So if you have large numbers coming from one country, say India, that's an impediment to assimilation. Basically, what it'll be is not really assimilation, but just outright colonization.
Yeah, well, we see that in the workplace now. Many of our larger corporations, you look at their IT shops, you look at back office staff, it's largely Indian. I was just speaking with someone literally an hour ago. He just left. His last two jobs were, he worked as a contractor, an IT contractor, with two of the nation's largest banks. And he has to be very, very careful about his identity, because, you know, he's very critical of the H-1B system, and in particular, India, and these third-party outsourcing shops like Infosys, Tata Consultancy Services, Wipro. And, you know, it's just absolutely dominated. These shops are dominated by Indians. So what you see is a level of social Darwinism taking place, where you have, there's no diversity in the workplace. Technology used to be, women were making great gains in the 80s and early 90s in technology, but all of that has been simply wiped away. You're not going to see, and And frankly, you're not even seeing the quality of workers. And as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of these employment visas, particularly in the quote-unquote skilled areas, the H-1B, they're going to people, workers that are quite ordinary. And the Center for Immigration Studies just did a really good article. I just put it up on our Facebook page, our U.S. Tech Workers Facebook page, demonstrating that these foreign-trained college graduates are not as well-trained, not as skilled as American college graduates. And it's not that we don't graduate enough people, we do. Only a little over a quarter of Americans who get STEM degrees are that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, are working in their fields. There's a disconnect there. And ultimately, it's greed. Professor Ronil Hira at Howard University recently released a study where he looked at the premium that an employer gets for hiring a level one and a level two visa worker. For a level one, they save 40% over an American counterpart. And for a level two, they save about 20%. That's what it's all about. And then you get a workforce that is quiescent.
Yeah, it's basically modern-day indentured servitude. I mean, some of them will go on and... So, I mean, some of those H-1B workers will go on and become very wealthy, but a lot of them will just be this class of people exploited, and basically it just exacerbates the issue of income inequality. And the other thing is it's so... I mean, you would expect this from these corporate Republicans, but it's really sad that you have all these progressives defending corporate propaganda, putting out corporate propaganda and defending this agenda.
Yeah, because it's really interesting how, and I was just talking with someone about this the other day, how unprincipled-centered people can be. When you look at, you know, leaving, you know, immigration and employment visas behind, you look at, for instance, the controversy with vaccinations, for instance. I don't really feel my weight either way on the argument, but it's really interesting. The people that will say, my body, my choice, when it comes to abortion, are like, not when it comes to vaccinations. Everyone's got to get a vaccination. So I'd like to see people be more principle-centered. If you believe that the government has a role to play in ensuring that there's a level playing field out there, that the economy is working for the workers and we're building a middle class, I don't see how they can support this unbridled immigration the way they do. It really befuddles me.
And another thing is a lot of people in the Midwest, they do have a lot of resentment towards blue states and California because they feel like they're being economically excluded, and rightfully so. But if we were to reform this H-1B program, basically people, the most well-educated people from all over the nation could go to places like the Silicon Valley, and same with other major prosperous metropolitan regions for work, and that would address a lot of the income inequality and provide opportunities for those people.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And even there's outfits like Pilar Technology. They have three locations in the Midwest, and they're increasing the size of their staff in Des Moines, Iowa, for instance, by reaching out to local high schools and starting them early in computers, starting kids early in computer science. So that's the way it should be done. We should be putting enormous asset or enormous resources into U.S. citizens and preparing them for work, because there's two other things that we haven't touched on that I think are really important. One is security, but the other is robotization. And this is where, you know, Andrew Yang is probably dead on in a lot of ways. Many, many jobs are just being automated out of existence when it comes to workers.
Are these primarily just lower wage jobs such as fast food worker, or do you think automation spread to software engineers?
Oh, no, we're seeing paralegals. We're seeing briefs put together by computer that are actually not so bad.
So as far as the positions that are going to H-1Bs, like, out of that, are those jobs vulnerable to automation?
Yeah, because a lot of them are back office operations that would be, and we're seeing it also. So they're vulnerable in two respects. We see this, there's a pattern when a company outsources its IT shop. Let's say a company has 220 IT workers, and they bring in a company called Infosys, which is an Indian-based consulting firm that employs a lot of H-1B visas. And they get, so, because you can't call it discrimination when you're outsourcing all the operations. So they come in some cases, they might tell the date of workforce there, if you want to get a severance pay, you got to train your replacement. And tragically, many do. And what happens eventually, a lot of that work will migrate overseas. A lot of that information work, a lot of the call center work, the maintaining of the data will migrate overseas. And that, to me, is exceptionally dangerous when it comes to issues of security. It's, as we know, if you maintain good security, you can protect things in the cloud. But when those servers are maintained in another country, what happens when the local intelligence and security officer knocks on someone's door and says, we really would like to have access to that server? I don't know if that's happening or has happened, but you have to be a little concerned when you think that much of our healthcare data already resides overseas. Much of our insurance information is residing overseas because, again, a lot of these back office operations have been outsourced and that work is migrating overseas. So, and financial data as well. As I had mentioned earlier, I was talking to someone who was telling me about many, many of the IT workers in some of our largest banks. These shops are largely Indian now.
As far as Trump goes, he also tweeted that he was in favor of giving H-1B visa holders, providing them with a path to citizenship.
Yeah, I remember the day that tweet came out. I was on a walk. It was probably 6:40 in the morning, and my phone lights up. And yeah, well, it was interesting because he said, he used the term highly skilled workers. And I'm like, well, we know they're not highly skilled, so maybe there's something in there. But no, I think he's getting some bad advice. And again, he hasn't connected those dots between the impact that these corporations love to say they can't find the workers. I can't find a worker. Well, a lot of it is they're looking for what they call a unicorn. They'll create job requirements that simply don't exist out there in the average tech worker. You're not going to find that level, that multiplicity of skills and levels of skills. But they seem to be more than happy to outsource it all to lower skilled foreign workers. So there's a real
thing. I think it's important to point out, I read somewhere on your website, Progressives for Immigration Reform, or maybe it's a tech workers website, that only 29% of Silicon Valley tech workers are U.S. citizens.
Yes. In fact, that's the big header, the banner that runs on the U.S. tech workers site. And when you think, it's kind of a tragedy because it was U.S. tech workers that built the Intels of the world, the Microsofts of the world, the Apples of the world. I forget the name of the Mosaic. What was the name of that company? I forget the first internet, easy to use internet screen. But I mean, Andreas, I believe, was the guy's name. But it's really kind of a tragedy to me that this has happened. And you can bet a lot of those jobs also have been moved overseas. And that to me is, again, it gets to national security. And it also is, why would you go and invest a lot of money in a college degree in, say, computer science or engineering, knowing that you're not going to have a job on the way out, or it's going to be really difficult to compete for an entry-level job? Because ultimately, we all have to get that entry-level job and get the experience in order to move up in our careers. And I'll give you a good example of that. I worked in accounting for a number of years, and I did a lot of business development in the state and local tax realm. And I was at a conference, and there was a woman from Deloitte & Touche, and she had just gotten back from their operation in Hyderabad, India. And they had about 40 people over there where they were doing what they call the personal property tax return. So if you're a company and you have locations in a dozen states, you might have to file a personal, if you have equipment in those states, you might have to file a tax return to the state and local government there. And they were doing this. They were outsourcing it. They were basically taking that whole these were, if you were a consulting firm like the one I was working with at the time, Ernst & Young, that kind of work was either done inside the company, or we would do it at Ernst & Young at one of our offices, maybe in Los Angeles or Dallas, something like that. But this was a twist, because it was now being done overseas, and they were saving a lot of money. And despite the initial problems that they were having in training the people, getting them acclimated to taxability issues to get the return right, it was starting to work out for them. But during the Q&A, I asked the question of her in the group. I said, okay, so someone graduates from college with an accounting degree, and they decide to go into, let's say, they want to do tax. Well, they get to a company, and the first thing that they're given to do is the return, because the return allows them to get very familiar with tax laws in different jurisdictions, like different states, different counties. What is taxable? What isn't? How are things treated? How is a pipe that runs above ground versus a pipe that runs below ground in a certain county in Texas treated? And that takes several years to really get good at that. And then after a while, you start getting into the planning, tax planning, and being advisor to the C-suite on tax issues. And all this takes time, but ultimately it starts with the return. But when you knock out that first rung, that very important first rung, where do you begin to build that level of expertise? And I think that can translate into almost any career path.
So there is another bill in the Congress sponsored by Representative Zoe Lefgren. She represents the area in the Silicon Valley around Palo Alto. And I read estimates that this would, basically this bill would give 75-80% of visas to Indian nationals.
Bill to Harris's bill. That's 1044.
So basically the two bills are identical.
Pretty similar. And what's interesting is I can't say that they're identical because I just haven't seen the text on them yet. They're very similar in intent to last year's H.R. 392. And I was kind of shocked to see Zoe Lofgren, there, because she actually came to the aid of tech workers at, I believe it was UC San Francisco. I could be wrong, but it was definitely in the Bay Area, a UC system school, where the chief technology officer decided, well, we're just going to outsource them and bring in an Indian firm. So, yeah, I was kind of, and I thought if she would defend them, what is she doing? Being, as you said, the sponsor to a bill like this. Grassley, interestingly enough, Senator Grassley, who I have enormous respect for, he is launching a bill to demand E-Verify throughout the country. And I think that would be great if we could pass that, because that will certainly tamp down on illegal immigration and the people that employ illegal immigrants.
It's far more crucial than the wall, because the thing about the wall is so many illegal immigrants, and not just from south of the border, a lot from India and Asia as well, do they just come here by plane and overstay their visa? So E-Verify is the crucial issue. As far as Trump goes, so basically the election of 2020 is coming up very soon, and Trump ran on this kind of message of speaking up for the forgotten man and all this populism. But basically what Trump's legacy will be a hybrid of plutocratic economic policies, including tax cuts for multinational corporations, deregulation, combined with very increasing legal immigration. So that's, if he votes for this...
I absolutely agree with you. I read that book, The New Plutocrats. I can't recall who the author was, but it really was an eye-opener on the new wealth. These people that just feel that they're so entitled, and I guess maybe because they feel they've quote-unquote earned their money, I don't know, but they just seem to feel so entitled, and they exercise so much control over...
Oh, okay, the Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, 2012 by Chrystia Freeland, or another one?
Yes, that's a brilliant book, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's, you know, we just seem to be everyone's punching bag. And what it tells me, too, and what I really stress when I'm working with tech workers, is don't attach yourself to any politician's coattails. What you need to do is create a movement that is so strong. For instance, when you are you're called into a large room, you and your coworkers, and you're told that, you know, this company is going to be given the contract to outsource your jobs, and you're going to have to train your replacements. Don't sign anything. Don't say anything. Walk out as a group. Shun anyone who doesn't. Get a lawyer. And don't go into work the next day. I mean, imagine if, let's say at Northeast Energy, which is an example of a company that had outsourced all of its IT shop, and all its entire IT shop, and had them train the replacements. Imagine if everyone in that room had said, well, see ya, we're not coming back to work.
Yeah, that's the thing is, people need to build a strong movement based on principles, not ideology. So whether it's just as the whole MAGA thing or the Trump movement goes, is people base their movement on supporting Trump, but if Trump fails or he's not reelected, then that movement will just cease to exist and we'll be back where we started. So it's better, yeah, not to attach ourselves to political parties or political figures. Kevin, we're getting close to the end of the show, but before I wrap things up, do you want to briefly plug Doctors Without Jobs?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually a great property of ours to talk about right now, because on Monday, March 11th, the match begins. It goes for, because initially, for people who are in their last year of medical school, they have already by now, they've gone out, they've applied for residencies across the country, and they will find out on Monday, March 11th, if they got a residency. Now, if they didn't get a residency, they'll find out by noon the next day if they've been picked up in the supplemental program. So positions that weren't filled, they'll find out if they've been put into one of those positions. And as I'd mentioned, every year, roughly 1,000 of our doctors who incur all the debts, go through the whole education process, don't get residencies, and roughly 3,700 foreign-trained physicians do get residency positions each year at U.S. teaching hospitals. It's bizarre. Why can't it just be 2,700 and all of our doctors get into a residency program? I see it's really, to me, it's a racket. It's heartless, and So Doctors Without Jobs, you know, pay attention. We will certainly be looking at to see what the percentages are like this year and the numbers. Typically, that 1,000 doctors represents about 6% of graduates of medical school, U.S. medical schools. And I'm not talking the Caribbean schools or anything like that. These are schools like Georgetown, Johns Hopkins. Roughly across the board, 6% don't get residency. So we're hoping with the work we've done last year that we'll see that percentage lowered. If not, we're just going to have to really kick it in, reach out to those doctors that didn't get residencies, and much like we're doing with U.S. tech workers. You know, we're forming, for instance, like in Hartford, Connecticut, we literally forced a meeting with one of the senior aides of Governor Ned Lamont to talk about his deal with Infosys. So when we come together as a group and organize, we can do something. So hopefully we'll be able to organize these medical students who have not gotten residencies a little better. And so we have doctorswithoutjobs.org, ustechworkers.com, and progressivesforimmigrationreform.org. People want to learn more about us.
Kevin Lynn, it's been an excellent show. Thank you for being on. It will be really fascinating to keep an eye on Trump to see if he signs that bill.
That's for sure. Rob, thanks so much for your time. Have a great day.